Howdy do, buckaroos. Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations Podcast. It is Friday, June 14th, 2019. I am your host, Kelly Gamont. With me today, I have Andrew Orr. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, hooray, it's Friday.
We've conquered yet another week. For some people, that I think was more work than others. I am one of those people. Also with me today, I have Brian Chaffin. Hi, Brian.
Hello. How are you, Kelly? I momentarily got my personalities mixed up. My apologies.
Oh, no. Yeah, it's hard when the voices in your head are louder than they should be. Yeah.
Than they should be, yes.
Yeah. As a friend of mine described it once, there's a circus in my head, and sometimes other people can hear the music. So on that note, I wanted to start today with an interesting link that you posted this morning, Andrew, about surveillance and the legal system.
Yeah, so it was basically this judge's perspective. Let's see what his name is. James Orenstein, or Stein. Mm-hmm. He works in the Eastern District of New York. He said some interesting things in his piece over at the New York Times, such as when prosecutors and other lawyers are going through and fighting these cases, most of the time they probably won't have our privacy in mind when it comes to, you know, these technology cases. Another thing he said I thought was interesting was basically like judge shopping, because he mentions he's one of the judges that if a prosecutor will ask him to issue sealed orders authorizing them to use like secret investigative technologies that might be privacy invasive, or making technology companies keep their, like, whatever they're doing with them secret, he usually doesn't approve those. So, of course, what they do is they just go to a more favorable judge. And that's actually, that concept is something that us in the Apple world is already familiar with, because I think it's with Apple patent trolls. Like, most of those cases are in the Eastern District Court of Texas, I think, because that the judges there seem to be more favorable to the smaller
the juries.
People.
It's the juries, actually.
Okay.
Oh. Yeah, those tend to be jury trials.
But that's where they're filing them is for that reason.
Yeah, and I guess it's the judge too. But regardless, Andrew's point stands.
Yeah, so I just thought it was a good perspective, because, you know, I don't usually hear about the legal side of it, like the legal perspective. It's just we as end users and whatever the technology company is doing.
Well, and part of that is that then this sort of thing becomes settled law without a law being passed. Like, Congress doesn't have to do anything if this is something that's being established in courts over and over again.
Yeah.
So that's another piece of it. And, you know, we've seen the lack of technological understanding on several fronts, right? Like asking the CEO of Google why things are happening on an iPhone, or asking in a government hearing, like, how can I update my iPhone, you know, when that's not really what they're talking about at all. And, you know, and there are senators and Congress people who get it. Like, we can't, you know, there are some who do and try to legislate based on that. But it's really hard to get people to pass a law or vote for a law, even when they don't have a whole lot of understanding of the technology, let alone how this law interacts with it. So that's part of what's been interesting about this is the judge shopping piece of it, like you said, is turning some of this stuff into law, into settled, you know, settled cases in certain environments. And it's not cool. Now, Brian, I know you have a stance on this.
I do. This might be surprising to long-term listeners of the show, but I do, in fact, have an opinion on this. First of all, I'm delighted this judge wrote. Yeah, I know, right? I'm delighted this judge wrote this piece. It's super interesting. And what he's essentially doing is asking Congress to start pass some freaking laws. Here's one of the takeaway quotes that I liked a lot that Andrew first identified. Quote, "For the public, as a practical matter, the rules of the road are being decided by prosecutors. Your privacy is not their highest priority." And the end quote, that sort of speaks to one of the things that I've talked a lot about from the standpoint of I believe that there should be constant tension between the forces of civil liberties and the forces of police powers. We don't live in a world where we can have all of the freedoms, but we don't want to live in a world where we have none of the freedoms. Mm-hmm. And so there should be a lot of pressure, a lot of tension between those two forces. And sometimes it's going to go too far one way, and sometimes it's going to go too far another way. But what he's talking about is the fact that you know, the police and prosecutors, they're not interested in our privacy. What they're interested in is solving or preventing crimes. And it is easier to solve and prevent crimes in a surveillance state. It is easier to solve and prevent crimes when the police can get into all of your stuff and watch every watch every step that you make, and you know, everything that you do and everything that you write, and have access to anything without a warrant, right? I mean, it's a lot easier to solve and prevent crimes when you can do that. But of course, that's not the kind of place that the United States has theoretically said it wants to be. Mm-hmm. And what's happening right now is that the laws are not keeping up with technological advances, and prosecutors, as a natural part of doing their job of solving, well, actually, they want to largely not solve and prevent crimes. They want to prosecute those crimes. But as a natural product of their top priority, which is punishing people who break laws, they're the ones who are sort of like writing a lot of the rules of the road by default, because Congress is not stepping up.
Right.
And that needs to change.
Yes. And like I said, there are people that are trying in Congress and not always getting as far as they would like for all kinds of reasons. So some are political, some are even simpler than that. Like, I don't understand it, so I don't have the time to spend on it, or I don't care for whatever reason, until, you know, because Apple hasn't written me a big enough check to care about consumer privacy yet. Like, that's the really cynical take on it. But
I don't think that's the issue, really. I think there's a lot of stuff that's competing for people's attention right now.
That's true.
And how many people are screaming about the importance of privacy? And the answer is none. None more screaming about the importance of privacy. Apple talks about it
in a reasonable tone of voice. They're not screaming.
Yeah, right. They're not screaming. I mean, like, this is not a hot button topic for enough people. You know, right. Far too many people are happy abrogating all of their rights, as long as they can be safe, or as long as they can get a free service.
Right.
You know, a quote unquote free service. So, yeah. Yeah, I really do think it's that. It's not so much about who's writing checks. I don't think that the police, the police unions that are writing checks to senators and congressmen for inaction.
Right.
That's not happening. That's not a thing.
No, but I think nobody's doing it for privacy or anything, and so that's why there's not some sort of newfound devotion to customer privacy either. Like, that's a very cynical take, but I'm not sure I'm entirely wrong. Because it does seem like a lot of times it takes a big fat check to get somebody to suddenly care about something. And there hasn't been, like, if every episode in 2019 of the Mac Observer Daily Observations podcast, where we talked about Facebook, doesn't convince you that maybe Facebook isn't the best place for you to be, like, yeah, there's more to it than that, I think. So it is a very interesting read. Part of what I liked about this piece in particular was how he talked about the process and walked through, like, lots of prosecutors are just waiting for me to not be the judge on the bench anymore. And I didn't even know that was a thing you could do. So I have very limited exposure to the legal system, so I didn't know how most of this stuff worked. So finding out that this is a process that's actually happening was really interesting to me in that respect. So if nothing else, it's a good read. If you do not subscribe to the New York Times, you should cash in one of your free stories this month and check it out. It was very good. And it's an opinion, like, to be fair. It's not like he's doing any hard news reporting or anything. It's an op-ed. New York Times, but it's definitely worth a read, especially if you don't know a whole lot about how cases sometimes progress through the legal system. So the other thing I wanted to talk about today is John Keat. Hi, John. he has an article over at Mac Observer that just went up about the Mac Pro. And yeah, Brian, you want to walk us through this? Because I know you kind of... help John refine his point of view.
Right. So John has 2 points.
Yes.
John has 2 points. The first point is that pundits and pundits who are apologists make it easy for Apple to not fix stuff. Mm-hmm. So, and to wit, that people are apologizing for the fact that Apple's Mac Pro, the new Mac Pro, doesn't start inexpensively enough for enthusiasts.
Okay.
It is a pro machine. Now, what he is not saying that the machine Apple releases is too expensive. This is an important differentiator.
Yes.
Right? He's not saying that the machine that was released is too expensive. What he's saying is that the enthusiast market wants a machine that has less, that is less expensive. Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot going on with the Mac Pro that enthusiasts don't necessarily want or need to pay for. Like, for instance, enthusiasts aren't going to put a terabyte and a half of RAM into the machine. Yeah. Probably aren't. So, I want to make that clear, because I get really cranky when people look at the Mac Pro and say that it's too expensive, because I don't think that's a thing. It's for
not for what it is.
For everything that's coming in that machine, if you need those things, it's not too expensive.
Right. For all it is and all it could be. That's the other thing.
Right. Well put. But what John wants to see is a less expensive slotted machine, because enthusiasts say they want slots. And he has all kinds of examples of enthusiasts whining and saying that they're leaving the Mac platform because, you know, Apple doesn't care about them, blah, 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 mm-hmm. which may or may not be the case. I actually think that there are many examples of people who have probably been saying they're going to leave the Mac platform for years, but whatever.
I can go back at least as far as it looks like candy. I'm not a Mac user anymore.
That's probably the case too. And there are, I also believe there is a case of Apple hearing that people want slots, but knowing that no one actually fills them.
And if anyone knows that, Apple knows.
It's Apple, yeah, because Apple, you know, the system reporting, the system profiling and that stuff, if you let Apple see that data, which I strongly recommend, they know that people weren't putting things in slots. Steve Jobs made that comment once upon a time. Now, in a conversation with John, I pointed out to him that Steve Jobs made this comment once upon a time, and he pointed out to me that Steve Jobs was wrong and lied a lot. But
just to show how long this conversation's been going on, it was Steve Jobs who said this. Let's just point that out.
Said that, like, you know, people like, you know, we've got basically got everything that PC people use slots for.
Yeah.
you know, Ethernet. We have Ethernet. We have Wi-Fi, and you know, all these things. This is obviously going back many years. So, but that actually doesn't detract from the fact that enthusiasts say they want those slots, and John's right about that.
Here's my. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I've been monopolizing the conversation. I apologize for that. His other point, though, his other point about like apologists saying that this machine isn't for you, so shut your trap, or make it easy for Apple not to fix stuff. And I don't know that I agree with that simply because I don't believe that Apple cares. John does, and he's not here to present his argument and make his case, so I'm simply pointing that out.
So here's the thing about it is that I've been hearing people complain not about the upgradability. That's the thing. Like when people are complaining about Apple not making a Pro machine for me, like the complaining that I was hearing didn't have anything to do with modularity, upgradability, slots, slotability, any of that. If slotability is even a thing, but those pieces, I wasn't really hearing anybody complain about that. I was hearing people complain about the price. I was hearing people complain about, you know, being able to get a hold of one because there's so much money and how am I supposed to afford this when the old towers were a lot less money proportionally, you know, and things like that. So mm-hmm. I wasn't hearing anybody complaining about like, this isn't a machine for me. And the machine that I want is a machine that I can upgrade. So that was like, I spoke with Chuck Joyner while we were at Dub Dub last week. And part of that conversation ended up being a little bit about how I wasn't hearing anybody complaining about upgradability because the Mac Mini only sort of has it. Like, you can try upgrading stuff in an iMac, but that would be the part of the upgrade map that says there be dragons. Because taking off that monitor is just, I don't even know how people do it. I'm really impressed. And I've cracked open my share of machines and yikes. But what I hope, and somewhere John thinks it's adorable that I have this much optimism. I guarantee it. It will probably show up as a comment in the show notes. Your optimism is adorable, Kelly. I hope that what Apple learned by developing this machine, building this machine, taking what we used to have in the old tower model, which was the unbelievable upgradability, you know, flopping that thing open on its side and being able to poke around in it, all that kind of stuff, or then, you know, later on just being able to slide off the panel and get in to do all the stuff you wanted to do in the previous iteration of the cheese grater model. Part of that, I would hope, is going to trickle down to some of the other models. Like, if it turns out to be a thing that people are actually doing and that people actually care about, and that all of these people do, in fact, put their money where their mouths are, and are upgrading stuff, like adding RAM later instead of paying Apple's price, or putting a bigger hard drive in something so they can get a little extra use, or whatever, you know, the kind of stuff that we used to do when it was far more feasible to upgrade your Apple hardware bits and pieces at a time to get an extra year or two of life out of it until the next thing came. I think, I would like to think that maybe this means the next iteration of the Mini might be a bit more modular, or that it might be a little bit easier to upgrade LOL. Something in a Mac Pro or something.
LOL.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think, I think that,
like Apple, I said, John's going to just think that's cute that I think that, but I do.
I think that Apple believes it is serving the enthusiast market with the combination of the iMac 5K and the iMac Pro and the Mac Mini. And that those devices actually meet the way enthusiasts actually use their devices. Again, only that doesn't address what enthusiasts say that they want, which is a more affordable, at the very least, slotted Mac. So, like, do remember that when the Mac Pro, the cheese grater, was originally introduced, it started at $2,200. Mm-hmm. Which was expensive at the time, but is not $6,000, and was, you know, not the equivalent of $6,000 at that time, mm-hmm. and was definitely a lot more affordable. John also pointed out that that the Display Pro XDR mm-hmm. is an amazing display, and it is where he didn't quite put it this way, but it's worth the $6,000 if you need a reference monitor.
Yes.
But that there's also a whole class of people, who, including Mac Mini owners, who want an Apple branded display. Say, for instance, a nice 27 inch 5K display that Apple sells on the darned iMac 5K. That doesn't, you know, that you know, maybe at that $1,000 or less mark, because they want an Apple display, and that Apple isn't meeting that need either. And I agree with that. It always baffled me why Apple stopped making displays a few years ago.
It baffles me because they still make iMacs.
Yeah, they
like, still have they're still making displays. They're just strapping a computer to the back of them, yeah. And that's confusing. I'm with you on that. And I do agree with John in that, like, in that case, like, why can't you sell me a screen? Because remember, like, not that long ago, I don't know if anyone's heard this, but Charlotte Henry, who's on the show regularly, she recently got a new computer and she bought a Mac Mini and she wanted a display to go with it. And she was prepared to pay Apple's price for a display and Apple didn't have one to sell her. And I know she's not the only person in that group. And how do I know that? Because I, too, have an external display that's not from Apple that could be, you know, I would have paid it. I had the money and I would have bought one of those beautiful, shiny glass, aluminum standard, great big displays. And it would have been beautiful and it would have been amazing. And that's not what I have because Apple did not have the capability to sell me one at the time. So I have a different one. And the only problem I have with this one is that sometimes it's hard to see it over the pile of money I saved by not paying Apple's prices for screens. So I think John is half right. I think he spent a lot of time on apologist pundits.
And he believes that's an important part of the argument. I disagree with him on that, but you know, it turns out he was writing the piece. So
yeah,
whatever.
I think he's got some valid points. It's definitely worth a read if you haven't seen it. Go check out his piece. It's if nothing else, it's an entertaining read. And and if you agree or disagree, you can leave comments on his post. You can also leave comments on the show notes for this particular episode of Daily Observations. And if you disagree with Andrew or Brian or I, you can do so by emailing observations@macobserver.com, or you can catch us on Twitter at TMO Daily. What's your take on this, Andrew?
I do like your idea of maybe this stuff will trickle down. Like Brian said, current machines, I agree with that. Like current machines do meet enthusiasts. The only thing that's really missing is just the upgradability. Mm-hmm. And that's what I thought would happen with the most recent Mac Mini. Was I thought it might have a modular design, and that would give us a hint of the Mac Pro. But maybe... Mm-hmm. Probably not, but this an idea would be maybe it's the other way around, where maybe the next Mac Mini will be more modular.
And that's my hope, is that something that if it turns out maybe this wasn't as complicated as they thought or as expensive, that maybe it will turn the Mac Mini into something a little bit more modular. Because it doesn't have to be, everything doesn't have to be glued in. Like, you don't need the thinnest, lightest Mac Mini ever, right?
Like, yeah.
It doesn't matter. So... It's my hope that's what's going to happen.
Agrees with that.
What?
I'm not sure that Apple agrees with that.
Oh, I don't think they do either. But it's I am hopeful. Because
let us take a bunch of Mac Minis, like stack them together and make kind of like a cluster out of them, like distributed computing on your desktop.
There you go. That's how they're modular. You just pull out a computer at a time and swap out the whole computer at a time. And then, the Beowulf cluster that lives under your desk. There it is. we'll see if that happens. We did get a recent update to the Mac Mini, so apparently it's going to be another 4 years before we get another. So it'll take a while to find out if this design actually trickles down to anything else or not. But when it does, you can bet we're going to talk about it. Brian, thanks so much for coming by today.
Yep, thanks for having us. It was good to be here.
Andrew, thanks for coming by.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And I've been your host, Kelly Gamont. On behalf of all my guests today, I want to wish you all a fantastic weekend. I will talk to all of you Monday. And in the meantime, be excellent to each other.